Abby.
And I'm Allie.
And it's
About Time for True Crime.
Hi.
Hey.
Hello.
Hello.
Happy Tuesday. Happy listening day, whatever day it is that you're hearing this.
Happy day that ends in Y.
How are you guys doing this week? What's up? What's new? How is your weird coworker? Do they still smell? Have you considered a Thanksgiving spray deodorant?
Oh, good idea. I'll pencil that away for when I need to get you something.
The gift of giving.
Yeah, thank
truly.
You.
We are good. This week has been short but long, but short, unfortunately, and so long.
Yes.
Yeah. Here in New England, it's starting to get dark a little bit earlier. The nights are getting a little chillier.
Mm.
My little heart is pitter-pattering and coming alive with the fall.
I will say I'm very, very happy for the fall coming, but I forgot that with that meant it's getting darker earlier. Well, okay, yeah, it's the big sad and it's all the things it always is. But like for me, man, I couldn't live in Alaska where it's like you could have 30 days of night or 30 days of day. Like I am so reliant on the sun to tell me how active I should be.
Same. It's like, oh, it's 5 o'clock and the sun's down. Guess I'm going to bed.
Yeah, like my body, like when it's dark at 4 o'clock, my body's like, so it's time for bed.
Yeah.
And what the fuck are you doing? Like, it feels wrong to clean when it's dark. It feels wrong to do any of the other productive things that I need to do. And there's no rhyme or reason for that. That's not logical.
No.
But the days get shorter and I'm like, so does my productivity.
Yeah, but I also think that like our bodies have evolved with our circadian rhythm being impacted by the sun. So
I would hope so. But I'm like lights out, night, sun's down, same.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, agreed. But I'm going to soak in the fall because I too get the big sad. However, I get this weird little like pep in my step because fall makes me so happy. It's almost like I go straight from slap happy, excited, like almost manic. Yay, it's fall. To like a very immediate instant crash of like, it's dark all the time and it's freezing and I can't go anywhere without a coat and I have to warm up my car and I want to die.
Yes. Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. And other people get the benefit of having a slow burn into that descent because they aren't manic about fall. But, you know, some of us just have to live with it. So
some of us that are at this table right now.
Yes.
But we are,
dare I say, all of us at this table right now.
We are autumnal sluts. We
oh,
just
my goodness, yes.
Love a good iced coffee day. Wear those boots. We love flannels. Bring us apple picking. Can we hit that corn maze?
Yeah.
Can we paint pumpkins?
Please, please.
Can we just have a scary movie night? Ooh, that brings me to a very important question.
Sure.
I am trying to get over my fear of scary movies. I do like them, but they do like chronically freak me out.
Yeah.
Like for 48 hours later, nobody can like look at me.
Yeah.
Funny, because I'll think like, oh my God, is that the thing from the movie? Like the lights are on. There's no scaring me.
Right.
If I need to go upstairs for something, will you come with me? That kind of thing.
Yeah.
But I'm, you know, trying to grow up as I inch closer to 30. I'm like, oh God, I cannot live life like this. What if I have kids someday that are going to be like, oh my God, Mom, I'm scared. Is there something under my bed? I'm like, I don't know. Check. Like, I don't want to do that. So anyway, all of that to say, I'm trying to watch some scary movies and this is like the time of year to do that. So I wanted to know what movies our listeners would recommend. And please don't give me the ones that are like messed up. You couldn't sleep, because if you're a fan of that and you couldn't sleep, I'm just going to cease to exist.
Well, I have a lovely little story for you that I think will make you feel better. I, too, am very interested in whatever our listeners recommend. I think they probably have great taste. Hopeful. Not sure if that's a brag. Maybe.
Oh, you guys, y'all have good taste.
I, for a long time, was my dear friend Mackenzie's reality check for scary movies. As in, she would tell me them, freaked out, and I would just go with her and debunk them. I'd be like, well, that can't happen because of this, because of that.
Like during the movie?
Well, after. We didn't always watch them together, but she'd be like, is it real? And I was like, you think a kid could fit through that grate?
Yeah.
So it was all like, I'd always find logical ways to debunk it. I'm not going to say that whatever it is exists, doesn't exist, all that, but I will tell you it's highly unlikely most of the time. Also, there's this cute little YouTuber called Ryan Hollinger, and he always does like reviews of scary movies. Mm. And he's got this cute little Irish accent, and he's always like, whoever, and keeps saying things. It's so cute. It's like the cutest way to get a debrief of a horror movie.
That's probably the best way to hear about it.
Yeah. So I think you should probably watch some of those and then pick one from that, because then you'll already know what happens. You'll get it delivered in a cute way, and then you can watch a scary movie.
Well, so I have two on my list that we've actually talked about in our friend group we need to have like a watch party for. Mm-hmm. Do you have any guesses? Do you remember?
I'm sure it's A24 related.
Of course it is. So one is it Midsommar or Midsommar?
Midsommar.
And then Hereditary.
Okay. We're going to do Midsommar first.
Okay.
It's fucked up, but it's more of like a take on cults and grief than anything else.
So it's more like a thriller, psychological, twisty ride than jump scares?
Hereditary is both fucked up, twisted, psychological thriller and jump scare. So I think we should work up to that one. It's also one that they don't really hold your hand through. So things happen and then they just move on from them. And you kind of have to be like, did that just? Okay.
And well, keep going. It's Toni Collette in that, right?
Oh, yes.
Our dear friend, Emily, wore, I'm pretty sure, her Toni Collette leggings when we went to Salem last year.
Yes, she has sweatpants that have Toni Collette screaming, and then I think it's her husband that's on fire on the other leg.
Which is just a sight to be seen.
And when she got her ear pierced, or her ears pierced recently, I got her like shrinky dink earrings of the same scene.
Oh my so god. She wears
those too. It's great. Ugh, what a queen. I miss her.
She's still alive. They just don't live together anymore.
Yeah, the audacity to move to a different state, even though I'm the one that said I was moving first.
Yeah, how dare she not just stay put?
Right?
I know, we're all grieving.
Very offensive.
We're grieving in different ways.
But I have quite the episode for you, and I know that I'm in good mood. But a lot of that is because this is an Albert Fish, baby. We are not talking about horrific crimes against children today. We're talking about horrific crimes against adults, but not kids. And not a shit ton of them.
I love that it's not kids.
Right?
Thank you.
You're welcome. That being said, we are not entirely out of the woods because it is, of course, a true crime podcast.
Correct.
So we have some things to talk about. So, yoo-hoo, skippers. Stop skipping.
Pot's on.
Pot's on. Come get.
Come here.
Come here, listener. So hi. Hello. Welcome or welcome back to your favorite true crime podcast about Time for True Crime.
You guys.
Aw. Today we are talking about a doozy of a case, but frankly, I think you'll find anything is a slight relief after Mr. Fish.
Thank you.
Today's is difficult because it was entirely preventable in every meaning of the word, in every way you can take that. It didn't have to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And full of primarily very good people who made a mistake in loving a man. Which, girl, who hasn't? But before we hop all the way in, I wanted to take a second to ask you how you picture yourself settling down in the years.
Mm-hmm.
I know here at the pod, we are the ripe young age of 20-somethings. And I know that some of you are already in your settled times, you know, but I am curious to see what that looked like in your head. I don't care if that's in your 20s, your 30s, your 40s, or beyond, but I want to share with you what I see in my future. Or at least what I hope for, okay? A girl can dream, please. Mm-hmm. For me, my ideal self is settled down when a few things happen. One, I have a partner that I'm comfortable with, authentic, honest, and silly with. Two, I have a home. This doesn't have to be the American dream, like white picket fence, but ideally someday, maybe I'd like to be able to own something in this damn economy.
Mm.
And three, I want things to get boring. I know this is a silly one, and I think it's one that a lot of people don't think about, but I crave time where I'm like, oh, just another Saturday, just another Wednesday, and things just sort of repeat. I think this is an interesting one because I think a lot of people get into some sticky situations when they find themselves bored. I don't think it's a destination for a lot of people. I think it's a barrier for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we see some of that today. But I'm curious to hear from you. When you're happy, when you're settled, are you bored? Does life get a little less exciting, even if it's a really good thing? So keep that in mind.
I love that. The answer for me is yes, yes, it does.
Right. And of course, when I introduce that to you, I think that boring is where most people run into problems. As neither a self-proposed doctor of love nor a married woman, I think you should take my observation only as you see fit. But I think people get into risky waters when they feel stagnant. And that's where I want to pick up in the case that we'll be talking about today. The murder of Morris Blinken Baker and Glenn Gabby Moore. But before we hop all the way in, just a little reminder to please follow, subscribe, etc. All of those good things. Everything is linked down below on our link tree. And if you're on Spotify, leave us a little comment. Also, from the top of my sources, My Favorite Murders episode 343, that's my personality, Anne Rule's book, A Fever in the Heart.
Yes, Anne.
All readable, the LA Times, and much more from archived newspaper clippings that happened from like the Daily News and other local spots from Yakima, Washington.
Oh, geez, Anne.
Oh, geez, Anne. For trigger warnings, today we're going to talk about murder, marital problems, and alcoholism. Keep you safe, B. The ATFTC fam wouldn't be the same without you.
Mm-hmm.
Now let's hop into it. Deanne Blinken Baker, wife of Morris Blinken Baker, and mother to their sweet two preschool-aged children.
Blinken Baker?
Blinken Baker.
I love that.
Yes, it's a very fun thing to say, and I do 100% keep wanting to say it like the Swedish chef from The Muppets.
Do it.
Deanne Blinken Baker. The Blinken Bakers. It's got like a bounce to it.
I think that's the Midwest in you.
The Blinken Baker. Anyway.
Can you spell it for me so I have the visual in my head?
B-L-A-N-K-E-N. Blinken.
Yeah.
Baker. B-A-K-E-R.
One word. No hyphen.
One word. No hyphen.
God, I love
Blinken
that.
Blinken Baker.
I love them already. Keep going.
So, Deanne was jolted awake in her home in Yakima, Washington on the night of November 22nd, 1975 to a noise around 2 a.m.
Okay, don't love that part.
Her bed was empty, her husband's side void of any human, but that was usual. Her husband, Morris Blinken Baker, worked as a security guard at a bar downtown during the nights. She also forgot about the noise, dismissed it as a car door or rolled over and whatever, went back to bed. But not even 3 hours later, around 5 a.m., Deanne startled awake again, surprised to not see Morris beside her this time. They had been together over half of their lives at this point, and she always woke up next to him. She got up and checked the couch for a possible just resting my eyes went wrong. That's so many dads know. But Morris wasn't there. She walked outside, checked his car, thinking, hoping, maybe he fell asleep in there before he came in. But the car was there. Morris wasn't.
So we think he made it home, or he never made it out.
And then Deanne checked outside, and it was that cold November morning that she found Morris Blinken Baker's body face down, dead in the snow in that November.
Oh.
And when the police came by, they knew just who did it. Or at least they thought they did.
Oh, geez.
So let's jump back in time. I think the first order of business is meeting the Blinken Baker family. Deanne was a cheerleader in high school when she met Morris. Morris, the all-American athlete, was a perfect fit for her. They were both beautiful. Anne Rule herself called Morris something of a Greek god with washboard abs, okay?
Anne. Keep it in your pants, Anne.
Thirsty, okay?
Dang.
But she was ready to drink up that little Greek god, you know?
Okay, and if you don't know why we're referencing Anne so much, you should listen to our series on Diane Downs. Oh, jeez. I'll
try to add that little clip in here.
Could you please?
Oh, jeez, it's in the transcript, Anne.
But Morris was also an incredibly talented wrestler and football player. Both were incredibly beautiful people, but both were also incredibly kind people, and they just clicked. They stayed together through college, where Morris got a 4-year scholarship to the Washington State University. And I want to say for wrestling, but it could have been for football, too. Morris was actually so gifted at football that he had been recruited to play professionally after college in the NFL.
Oh, wow.
Crazier, he declined that because he wanted to settle down with Deanne and start a family and fulfill his lifelong dream of becoming a coach.
Oh, that is so wholesome.
The two settled down, they found a home, and they got married. Deanne, in between her pregnancies and afterwards, worked at a bank once they had settled. And the little family fell into a routine. Morris worked at the high school as a coach. And to make ends meet, he also held his night job as a bouncer at a local bar. But it was coaching that really made his heart sing. See, Morris was perfect for the role of a coach. Not only was he good at sports, he had experience and particularly wanted to coach, which I don't know if you know this, but I do feel like a lot of coaches are people whose careers ended against their will and they just need to be involved in the sport still.
Those who can't do, teach.
And those who can't teach, teach gym. Thank you, Jack Black. But Morris really wanted to be a coach. He was kind-hearted, patient, and had a cool temper, which were all strengths that Morris was pretty universally known for and pretty universally make good mentors, good mm-hmm. coaches. Everyone who knew him said that he was their friend and would do anything he could for you, and he was a real family guy. The other trick that Morris had up his sleeve to be a good coach was that he had the best coach as a kid. Glenn Moore, who went by Gabby, so we'll call him Gabby.
Okay, Glenn?
Glenn.
Never heard that name before.
Me either. And just as a note here, in every source but one, I saw Glenn, like Glenn with a Y instead of an E. But I did see one that said Blynn, B-L-Y-N-N. I think that was a typo, but just so we know, it's possible. Okay,
good to know. But he chose Gabby instead.
Yes.
I would have gone with Glenn, but that's me.
Right? It's interesting. I don't really know the story there, but...
Yeah, we'll see.
We'll call him Gabby.
Gabs.
So Gabby and Morris had an interesting relationship. A good one. You know, very much like a mentor and a mentee, but that dynamic changed in the early 70s. Gabby was actually Morris's middle school wrestling coach, which is when they met. But as time went on, they stayed in touch. And in the 70s, the two had obviously stayed in touch through Morris's schooling years and eventually planned a whitewater rafting trip together.
Okay, so now both, you know, with the Morris in adulthood, now they're just friends.
Right. And during this trip, I mean, it's in Yakima, Washington. It's a very dangerous adventure, okay? Like, I've gone whitewater rafting in the Midwest. Yeah.
Okay.
And it was fun. I mean, it had its moments. It was a little bit scary, but it's the Midwest. Like, with what altitude am I going to fall? You know, nothing. In Yakima, there's a bit.
I want to go to the West Coast so bad. I want to see Washington. I want to see it all.
I really want to go to Redwood, but of course I do.
We're going to go. So let's just plan it.
Part of this problem is that Gabby fell into the water and actually almost died. He almost drowned.
Oh, that's terrifying.
Terrifying. And during this, Morris was such a strong athlete and swimmer, he jumped in after him and saved his life.
Dang.
So now, I mean, it's not quite like this relationship was flipped on its head, but what used to be more of like a mentor-mentee friendship turned kind of friendship now is like, I owe you my life, dude.
Yeah, that changes things.
It does. And it turns into something far more equal afterwards. You know what I mean? Just in terms of like, Morris views Gabby as this idyllic mentor that he's had his whole life. And now he's proven himself to be able to do this for him. You know,
this makes me very happy, but this is a true crime podcast. So I know that I will not be happy long, but I'm loving this for them right now.
Yeah, savor that.
Okay.
So it only made sense to Gabby then, in 1973, when his wife and him were going through some rough times, that he would turn to his good friend Morris. Morris, being a family guy and a good husband, talked it through with Deanne first. Deanne was skeptical. They had routines. They had two kids that were preschool age, like very young kids,
mm-hmm.
and a life that they had created. And I'm adding some ideas here, but if Morris was working a second job to keep the family comfortable, my guess is they probably also weren't rolling in money. And not that that means anything, but due to that, they also probably didn't have a giant house that had a billion guest rooms to house your old wrestling coach.
I think that's a fair assumption.
But eventually, Deanne said okay. I mean, she knew Gabby just as long as Morris had. They weren't as close, of course, but she knew him. And they had built a good bond, and he needed their help. Plus,
she was like, yeah, I remember you. You were a coach at my high school. Like,
yeah, what up, dude?
20 plus years ago. How's it hanging, fella?
Plus, they knew he would do the same for either of them if it had been the other way. So Gabby moves in September of 1973. He had told Morris that he needed a place to land until he could get on his feet and ideally work things out with his wife. And this is when there's a second large shift in dynamics, because it turns out that Gabby needed help in another area too, just when he wasn't willing to ask for help with.
Ooh, ruh-roh.
Morris finds out that Gabby is secretly a raging alcoholic.
Oh, no.
Now, Morris probably felt so conflicted. On one hand, this is his mentor, his coach, likely one of the first adults that he ever really had believe in him and see his deep potential for a sport that he loved. And now, not that I need to remind you, I'm a varsity athlete. Okay? Yes, that sport was bowling. And hey, I was one of the best on the team at eating mozzarella sticks and doing my sport at the same time. But it was a sport, damn it. Okay.
Yeah, she got a varsity letter, you guys. You can step out of the way. Sit down.
And I understand how weird coach dynamics can be. They can be awesome. Don't get me wrong. Like, yes, there's an element there of mentorship of someone that is a trustworthy, reliable adult that you can go to. But there's also an element, yes, at getting better at the sport, but there's lessons that coaches teach you otherwise. The value of practice and dedication and setting and pursuing goals. They can instill in you the tools you need and the confidence you need to become the kind of person you want to be outside of whatever silly little thing you're doing for a game, you know? Mm-hmm. And sometimes, yes, there's competitions. Coaches will give other athletes attention and maybe you get jealous over that, or they give somebody else playtime and you're like, what the fuck? I'm way better at them. Why didn't they put me on first and not as, you know, I don't know what happens after the starter. I don't know that many sports words, but you know what I mean? There's some competition there. And there's someone that you want to make proud. There's someone that you want to impress and also have them say, oh my gosh, great job. You've been working at that and you did the thing.
Yeah, because and there's an investment. And then it's also about you and the success of the team. And it's right. All that. And I can imagine that being him, it's like I've idolized you. And then there's maybe a part of him where it was like, was I wrong in doing that?
Right. Well, and this was a cry for help because Morris, I mean, keep in mind, I think they're in their 30s at this point.
Morris and his wife?
Yes.
Okay.
And Morris has known Gabby since he was, what, 12?
Mm-hmm.
So 20 years. And he's known this man. When he was in school and growing through it, Gabby always preached health. And I don't know if it was total sobriety, but at least healthy relationships with substances. Like, this was not the kind of thing that, if it was going on, he advertised. And with the extent it was going on, it seems unlikely that he has been maintaining this for 20 years.
This is making more sense that the sudden divorce happened and he suddenly needed a place to go that he would probably not be able to support himself.
Right. And so, of course, Morris wants to make Gabby happy. He wants to be there for him and to offer him help.
Yeah, he's and support. Got a friend struggling.
And yet, on the other hand, Morris has already saved Gabby's life once. And now they're kind of on an equal playing field. Some of that mystery and, I guess, alluring sort of air about coaches and adults that believe in you as kids is gone. He knows this person in their entirety. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know about you, but when I was like a kid in elementary school, it was so weird to see a teacher anywhere but school.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you just can't process contextualizing them somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And so that has all faded. He's now seen Gabby in every state.
Including very intoxicated, I'm sure, or right. Struggling and like withdrawing.
But he also just got Deanne on board, and now he sees his old coach needs even more help and that he's drinking way too much. And when he's drinking, he is an explosive and mean man. He is an angry drunk.
And not only that, but Morris is, I mean, he wants to help this guy, sure, but his main priority needs to be his wife and his children.
Right.
Does he want his children exposed to that?
Right. But here's the thing. Morris gets stuck and he tries to keep the peace. He doesn't want to give up on his coach, but he does not want his kids or Deanne to be exposed to this. So he does, I think, what he naturally saw as his only solution, and he tried to help hide it.
Oh.
He tries to keep it away from Deanne. He keeps it away from the kids. He tries to help through whispers. And to his credit, it worked. But here's the thing. It worked too well. Gabby stays with the Blankenbakers, and 1 month turns into two. And then a few months into just a landing pad, Gabby was still at the Blankenbaker home with no end in sight. In fact, it didn't even seem like he was working on things with his wife and trying to mend a strained marriage. So
he's got it made right now.
Yep. So Morris approaches Gabby and he's like, hey, you know, what's up with that?
Hey,
buddy. And
rent's due on the first. Is that how we're doing it now?
Or? Yeah, right. And Gabby said, listen, yes, I know it's weird, but I'm done working on it with my wife because I'm in love.
With your wife?
Yes.
Stop it.
Yes. He says, I'm not in love with my wife. I'm in love with Deanne and I need to have her.
What?
Yep.
The fucking gall.
And that
kidding me?
He did. Not even 3 months into moving in with the Blankenbakers, Gabby had successfully made a move in on Deanne. And to Morris's surprise, she didn't reject it.
What?
Instead, Morris found Deanne telling him she wanted to pursue this, to get a divorce, and to try a relationship with Gabby.
Oh, that makes me so mad.
Anne Rule had a hell of a take on this, which fully made me cackle when I heard it. But she said something along the lines of that it seems highly unlikely that Gabby would be attractive to Deanne. He was 42, nowhere near as handsome as Morris, but he had the benefit of being an unknown.
Absolutely.
And to this, I'll remind you, Deanne and Morris had been with each other since they were in high school. If they're in their 30s, I think they had been married for 9 years, but together for something like 17. And Gabby was significantly older than the pair, yes, but that might have been appealing. She got bored. And she didn't let that boredom be filled with other pursuits, hobbies, and fun things to try like a local fair. She let that boredom be filled with Gabby Moore.
Well, and I think, you know, over time, I'm assuming, as neither of us, as we sit here unmarried,
mm-hmm.
and we speculate on what it must be like to be, you know, 20 plus years into a relationship and at least a decade into marriage, that the dust kind of settles.
Yeah.
And it just is. And that sort of honeymoon phase or phases have passed. And I think that it probably gets to a point where love is important, but mm-hmm. so much else is more important almost. Like,
yeah,
love is the basis of it, but there's respect and loyalty and ethic and dedication, and that you can both have a time of falling out, but it can't be at the same time.
Right. And, you know, ultimately, they've got kids. They're preoccupied. They've got, I'm assuming, at least
responsibilities.
Yeah, daycare or teaching or rearing to do. Like, kids are a lot of work. I don't have any, but I know enough to know that. And a lot of people, I think, per Mrs. Abel Dabelson, this is not from my experience, I have no kids, but I think a lot of people have kids and they forget about their relationship. They don't tend to it.
And I think that that's really common, and I think that it's important to foster that relationship, but also, like, your job is being a good parent.
Yep.
And a good wife and husband, but a good parent. You are the role model. You are the lens that your children are going to look at everything through, and you can't lose sight of each other in that either, but you can't neglect any of them, I guess.
Right. And, you know, when you're a caregiver, you are giving care to someone who is entirely dependent on you that, not for nothing, did not ask to be brought into this world. So if they have no ability to be independent the way that us adults are, you best be giving your damn to that. Like, you best be giving your all to them.
Of course. But okay, my ass is so chapped right now. You mean to tell me that this man moves into his house, hey, I used to coach you before, and you saved my life before, and I know that you're responsible and you're doing all right, and my life's in shambles, can I come stay with you? And Morris is like, let me open my heart and my home to you, my family will make adjustments for you, and then I will hide your alcohol addiction from my own wife to try to preserve your reputation in the eyes of my family. He preserved Gabby's reputation so well in the eyes of his wife, that she just had to fuck him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I hate everything about this. Keep going.
Yes. And, you know, remember, Gabby was once a coach. So there is, like, a significant age gap between them.
Of course. That's inappropriate. That's like dating your student.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, not you guys are all adults now, but, like, I feel like when you watch someone grow up,
there's a very blurry, very thin line there.
I
personally, and you know, I'd
never cross.
I stay far away from that very blurry thin line. I don't want to know. I don't want to know where it is. I don't want to know when I accidentally step over it. So I'm going to be way over here.
Uh-huh.
Not even close. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
I can't even see it. I'm squinting. Where is it?
Yeah. No clue. So this happens, right? Less than a year later, in June of 1974, Deanne officially tells Morris that she wants a divorce after 9 years of marriage.
Are you kidding me?
They had kids. They were high school sweethearts. They started life together. And that September, exactly a year after Gabby moved into the Blinkenbaker home, Gabby and Deanne get married.
What?
With a grieving, heavy heart, Morris moves out of the home.
He moves out of his own home.
And Gabby and Deanne try their hand at marriage there.
I want to like buy five plates and break four just for Morris.
Yeah.
Like I just have the poor guy.
Yep. And then one for you, hopefully.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. And it should be noted here that not for nothing, this was the talk of the town.
Of course it was.
Talk about a scandal. What a betrayal. Not only by your wife of almost 10 years, high school sweethearts that everyone knew as like the best athlete and cheerleader in their school. So kind and sweet to everyone, settled down and happy. And according to Anne Rule, hot as hell. Okay.
Yeah. Greek god over here.
And then you add that to have this done to you by your childhood coach that you idolized, whose life you saved.
Twice.
And then you opened your home too. But nonetheless, it didn't take long for Deanne to find out what a grave mistake she made. Not only was Morris gone from her life, but his absence also meant he couldn't hide Gabby's drinking from her.
The grass is always greener.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope hers burned.
It was a quick descent into life with an abusive alcoholic for Deanne.
I do not condone abusive relationships.
No, but it's a real, well, if it isn't the consequences of my actions kind of moment, huh?
Yes, how the turntables.
Indeed. But Gabby got explosive and angry when he drank. And he could drink a fifth of bourbon in 2 to 3 hours. Which, for those of you who don't drink much like me or just need help conceptualizing, Google says there's about 16 shots in a fifth of liquor. So that's 16 shots every 2 to 3 hours frequently of bourbon.
Wow.
That's a lot of fucking liquor.
After 3 shots, I'd be on the ground.
After 3, I'm dead. After 3, I'm passed out. I'm sleeping. I've taken a nappy. Okay? I need help.
I'm in my fat pants by 3 shots. I'm in
the recovery pose.
Yeah. I've got my water and some liquid IV and some fucking crackers.
Yep. Okay? And a little trash bag with an old grocery fucking bag in it just in case.
And then you're like, ooh, the mistakes I've made.
Yes. And then you never drink bourbon again because you tasted it on the way down and the way up.
Correct.
Yeah. But no, that's not Gabby. Gabby's like, wait, I want more. Actually, well,
yeah, and
another one.
Obviously, he's struggling, but he is still responsible for all of his decisions. And I'm really pissed at the wife.
Yeah.
Shame on her.
And
you do that to your family, to your kids.
Oh my gosh, those poor kids.
And then who have to now be exposed to this man who is abusive and potentially violent, or at least emotionally, at least just unavailable.
Right. I mean, I'll be honest. I don't know exactly what their arrangement with the kids were at this time. I hope Morris took them,
but, you know.
Same, but also.
But she's the one with the house. How's he affording it himself to have a place for the kids to stay?
Right. Since it sounds like he's the one that left, I can't imagine he would ask them to pack up their rooms to go live with him. So I don't know. But Deanne has said that Gabby would love you one moment and throw you out the next. Less than a year after Gabby and Deanne get married, in June of 1975, Deanne has had enough. She goes back to Morris.
She's not pregnant.
No.
Okay.
And she apologizes profusely. She's sorry. She made a mistake. She misses him, and it's not what she thought it was.
Okay, well, you made your bed. I hope it's comfy. Now you can lie in it.
Do you want to know what Morris says?
He took her back because he's a good man.
He says, I love you. I forgive you. Come home.
Ugh. I have a lot of thoughts because I get it.
Right?
But, oh, no, I get it.
And they reconcile. They reconcile with plans to remarry and to reunite their family and work on themselves. I assume Morris moves back into the home, but I know for a fact that Gabby moves into his own apartment.
Dude, it's like the changing of the guard at this place. It's like, oh, mm-hmm. He's there, Gabby's in, he's out, he's back, Gabby's out. Like, come on. They're working shifts.
Literally. And while Deanne and Morris were working on their relationship, getting themselves right, rebuilding those attachments that had been broken or strained, Gabby wasn't. And he wasn't giving up.
Because he wanted Deanne?
Yes. In fact, it made him hell-bent on getting Deanne back even more. He basically became obsessed with her. He'd call her daily. He'd stop by. He would call her at home and then at work and then again at home after her shift. Sometimes he'd stop by her work. And he'd often tell her awful things, a trigger warning here for a suicidal ideation, but he would say multiple times that he wanted to take his own life in front of her so that she would end up in the psychiatric ward of the hospital. This is a very unwell man.
Oh, ain't he sweet?
Mm. So when we fast forward to November 22nd of 1975, this is the world where Deanne wakes up to find her husband, her reunited love, dead in the snow, and she is inconsolable.
Oh my God, I forgot we started with the, it's Morris that died. I'm so mad.
Mm-hmm. The police come and do their search, of course, but it was just 2 years shy of Gabby moving into their home.
Wow.
His obsession with Deanne and the long history we just covered, he was immediately their number one suspect. The police could practically taste it.
So the course of everything between Gabby moving in, their relationship beginning, their marriage,
mm-hmm.
and then their split and Deanne back with Morris happened in 2 years.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. A very eventful 2 years.
I bet you'd take boring right about now.
Yep. And this is just another fun moment to say the grass is greenest where you water it.
That it is.
Check your fucking gardening supplies before you make any major life decisions. Thank you.
This has been a PSA.
Back to your regularly scheduled content. There was a small problem.
Mm.
Gabby had a rock solid alibi. As rock hard as Morris's abs. Okay? And that was hard.
Just chiseled.
He was in the hospital overnight with incredibly high blood pressure.
Guilt?
Maybe. On tape, medical records corroborated everything. The scene had very little evidence. Winter elements like wind and sleet and snow tend to disrupt scenes and DNA, and there were no witnesses. So the number one suspect was essentially just eliminated from the list because they determined Morris's time of death to be about 2 a.m., and Gabby had checked into the hospital significantly before then and checked out significantly after then.
Yeah, and it's the 70s. It's not like we had the technology that we right. have now. So,
and the police weren't ready to give up entirely, though. I mean, of course, they keep their investigation going. But while they're looking into other leads, they're trying to get creative with how Gabby might have done something. I mean, like I said, everybody in this town said Morris was their friend. He did not have any other enemies. Nobody else that disliked him. Nobody else that was jealous. Well, I mean, maybe they were jealous, but not enough to outwardly say anything or show any discontent.
I think the man's been through enough.
Right. And the police are like, it can't have been anyone else. It makes no sense for this to be anyone else. So they're trying to get creative. They look in to see if he could have snuck out of the hospital. I mean, sure, he was checked in, but maybe he could have sneaked his way around.
Mm-hmm.
And sure, yes, they find that he could have snuck out of the hospital without getting noticed, but sneaking back in would have been insane. It would have taken divine intervention. His room was right in front of the nurse's desk, and there was only one way into the hospital wing that he was in that gets locked after visiting hours. And 2 a.m. is certainly after visiting hours.
Well, you know what wouldn't require him to leave? A hitman.
That's true. But police reached out to other people, and nobody else had any reason to dislike Morris. So they just kept trucking.
I don't. He sounds great.
Yeah, right. Gabby's behavior isn't getting less weird, though. Deanne and the kids are just trying to get through their first holiday without Morris. Thanksgiving was 2 days before Morris's death, so they're gearing up for their first Christmas without him.
Oh, what a rush of emotions from having probably a happy Thanksgiving, like their first one back as their family again. And
now they're envisioning Christmas without a loving husband and father. But somehow, All of this amps up to get Gabby even more dead set on getting back into Deanne's life.
What a prick.
I mean, she was disgusted. She wanted nothing to do with him, but that didn't stop him.
Yeah.
He's adamant he's not involved in Morris's death, of course, and he tells Deanne and the police often that he's afraid for his life. He says that he's a victim of a stalker, too. Someone keeps calling him and leaving threatening messages for him and his mother.
Okay.
At some point in the next few weeks, he even reports that someone shot in one of the windows of his apartment.
Sure.
And Gabby becomes so paranoid that he actually creates funeral plans with his daughter just in case.
Okay.
Which, like, not for nothing, Gabby, but, like, maybe this isn't the time. It's Christmas. Can you let her have this one? A Christmas miracle, maybe? Not about you?
Something, maybe, thanks. Potentially.
Anyway, as Gabby was saying, seemingly paranoid, somehow his fears came into fruition. On the night of December 24th, 1975, someone broke into Gabby Moore's home and shot him to death.
No way.
Spooky.
He really was? Okay.
Yeah, sorry for my sassy comment earlier, Gabby.
I'm not, because I don't like you very much, but I'm sorry that you were murdered on Christmas Eve.
Yeah, that sucks.
That sucks.
That being said, this leaves investigators stumped, likely second-guessing everything. How could this man, the only one who's had reason to have something to do with Morris Blankenbaker's death, obsessed with his wife, heavy in the bottle, and blabbering paranoias to anyone who will listen, how was he right about being stalked? How could they have missed it? Was he telling the truth this whole time?
No.
They essentially have to start over.
What a complete cluster, though.
Truly. And initially, they thought Gabby died of a heart attack. He was found face down, and there was almost no blood present at the scene.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It wasn't until they actually moved his body to go to either the autopsy or maybe have, like, the forensic scientists come in that they noticed there was a very small spot of blood near his right shoulder and a bullet wound.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And it's his right shoulder. So it doesn't make a lot of sense. Besides, they initially thought a heart attack maybe because he was just in the hospital for high blood pressure.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it would have connected. And when they see this bullet hole, this wound, and they have the forensic analysts test it, they find that it was made by a .22 caliber bullet. And they also, I think, found the case at the scene as well.
But if it's in your shoulder, would that kill you?
Well, isn't that weird?
That's
the thing.
Yeah, okay.
So maybe there was a high school athletic coach serial killer on the loose?
Sounds like it, right? Oh my God.
Right? These two men die, like, within relatively rapid succession, and that, other than Deanne, is the only thing they have in common.
Yeah, that's like probably almost a month exactly.
Right.
Okay.
So the police keep searching, hunting, investigating, questioning, analyzing, etc.ing. But it's not until 2 months later in 1976 when some kids are going fishing, which, can I just, why are you fishing in February in Yakima? Is this ice fishing?
Ice fishing.
All right, I'll take it. But
I'm assuming.
You're not skipping rocks, I know that.
No.
So these kids go fishing and they find a rusted Colt .22 caliber pistol in the river.
Mm-hmm.
The kids, of course, are good kids and turn it in. And my favorite murder was actually making me laugh so hard because they were like, what, were these kids fishing with magnets? Like, how do you get a gun to bite on your bait? I don't know. But it was a hysterical picture. Love it. So the police released this information to the public, hoping for any help, whether someone saw something, knew anything about the gun, or any new information that was true would be helpful for them. And boy, does the public know something. A woman named Loretta Scott, at least that's her name in Ann Rule's book, I don't know if Ann Rule anonymized this or not, called into the tip line and said, okay, all right, you got me. Okay, the gun is mine. I threw it in the river. All right, but I'm not your killer.
Yeah, okay.
And the police are looking at each other like the surprised fucking Pikachu meme, because the fuck you mean you own this and discarded it in a river, but you didn't do anything wrong with it.
But I know who did.
Right? Well, police department, in my telling of the story, if you had let me finish, you would have found out that it wasn't Loretta Scott, but she knew who it was.
Mm.
In fact, it was her cousin, Angelo Pleasant, who went locally by the nickname Tuffy. Tuffy Pleasant.
Stop it.
Okay, but I actually refuse to call anybody Tuffy Pleasant, so I'm just going to call him Angelo or Pleasant. All right?
Okay.
Because that's a ridiculous name. So,
oh, God.
Loretta said that her cousin had borrowed the gun twice, once in November and once on Christmas Eve. And when the details were released about the murders, she put two and two together, panicked, thinking that she might have a murder weapon in her home. So she, and this is a quote, chucked it in the river.
That's what I would do.
Right? No, you tell the fucking police. But while perhaps this is not the ideal first case scenario, I'm glad she did call them when more information was put out again.
She said, get rid of it.
But you might ask, Abby, wonderful narrator, storyteller, historian, nerd, varsity bowler, who in the damn hell is Angelo Tuffy Pleasant?
That you took the words right out of my mouth.
Great question, babes. Let me tell you. Angelo Pleasant was a young man on the up and up. In 1975, when this is all taking place, he's in college. He's 22 years old, and he's an incredible athlete.
Tuffy.
In fact, he was on track to wrestle in the fucking Olympics.
So, like, what's in the water over here? Where are all these star athletes coming out of this particular place in Washington?
It's the Yakima water.
Apparently.
It's full of testosterone. I don't know. The only thing that he had in common with Morris Blankenbaker was his youth wrestling coach, Gabby Moore.
Okay.
Pleasant and Gabby had a very similar relationship to what Gabby and Morris had, but without any of the equality. Pleasant still idolized Gabby as his big capital C coach, a role model, someone to look up to and to impress and make proud. And while he was about 10 years younger than Morris and about 25 or 30 years younger than Gabby, he was there for him just the same. Through the divorce with Gabby's first wife and then Deanne, and through the unstable living situation and the spiral into alcoholism.
So he had somebody else. Gabby had somebody else he could have reached out to. He was trying to get in there so he could get with Deanne from the start.
Yeah. I mean, also keep in mind, Pleasant is a 22-year-old college kid. I don't know that Gabby really wants to be sleeping on the floor of a dorm.
I feel like he'd love it.
He might, actually.
Personally.
Pleasant was there for all of it, though. He reported that it was always about Deanne, and if Gabby felt something, he felt something. So when Gabby cried, Pleasant cried. He said that Gabby was torn up and not himself, and that one of the lessons Gabby always taught him was that if you have a problem, you eliminate it. And to Gabby, and therefore to Pleasant, Morris was the problem.
What?
So Pleasant agreed to kill Morris while Gabby was in the hospital.
So it was kind of a hit.
Mm-hmm. In fact, Gabby called Morris from the hospital to set everything in motion.
Are you kidding me?
It was the perfect cover-up. Except that instead of running back into his arms like a brainless shell of a human being, Deanne was a grieving mother who had divorced Gabby for more reasons than Morris simply being alive.
Mm-hmm.
And she reconciled, did what she could, and he never got over it. So when she didn't come crawling or running or begging or anything, Gabby didn't take no. Of course not. Why would he? He got even more desperate. And he wasn't about to let a little murder or violent alcoholism ruin a shot at a good thing.
Ugh.
So a few months later, Gabby goes back to ask one more favor of his star pupil, Angelo. He says, Angelo, my man, shoot me in the shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
If I get hurt, then I'll crawl over to Deanne's sister's house, which will not only get me out of being a suspect for Morris's murder, but also she'll feel sympathy for me and it'll win me back Deanne.
Ah, yes. Sympathy sex. My favorite.
So God knows why he did it, but Angelo Pleasant agreed to do this as well.
This kid must have been groomed. There is a...
That's what I mean. maybe he felt indebted, maybe he believed it all, and maybe there's some weird bond in there or abuse of power from a man who once held all of Pleasant's dreams and confidence. That part of Pleasant still wanting to please and obey what Gabby wanted. But he's now a full-grown adult with enough of a brain developed that he knew the stakes and what he was doing was wrong and permanent. And he was on track for the fucking Olympics. I don't know what more validation you need in your sport than that.
Seriously, what do you need from this guy?
Right? But he still agrees to do it.
He's just so, like, manipulative and mean. He just sounds like a nasty person.
So Pleasant does one last favor for Gabby. But this is where it all went wrong. Pleasant did break in on Christmas Eve. He used the same gun. He pointed it at a safe spot where he and Gabby identified as safe in the upper shoulder. And I don't know if it was kickback, if Pleasant was a bad aim, or if Gabby moved. But after the firing, the bullet didn't really hit Gabby's shoulder. Not at first, at least. I think it went through, but it ended up hitting his fourth rib. Mm. And one of the very interesting niche things about a .22 caliber pistol is that the bullets can spiral and ricochet in your body after they hit bone.
Mm-hmm.
So when it hit his fourth rib, it ricocheted through his lungs and heart, resulting in death almost instantaneously.
That sounds like karma to me. Man, I'm not going to advocate for anybody dying. That's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying it did happen. And it happened like 50 years ago. And I can say that that was another set of the consequences of his actions. You killed a man or had a man killed. You took advantage of who was probably another ill young adult. And you said, yes, I will have this man commit murder for me so that I can steal that other guy's wife.
Yep.
And then help alleviate the suspect look on me. So if you could just give me a wee flesh wound.
A tap.
So that I can say that I have been harmed and there's no way I could have done this to myself. That this will all work out great for me.
Right.
So yeah, I think he, you know, again, the bed has been made.
And now he is forever lying in it.
Ooh, naughty.
So I won't waste much of your time with the arrest and trial. After Angelo's cousin, Loretta Scott, had called in with this information, he was promptly arrested, confessed, and pled guilty. But, of course, not before trying to blame a friend and his little brother for the shootings first.
Aw, man.
He was tried for both deaths in the same trial and was found guilty of the first-degree murder of Morris Blankenbaker and the first-degree manslaughter of Glenn Gabby Moore after a two-week trial in August of 1976.
So they did believe him on the second one that he didn't mean to kill him.
Yeah.
Okay.
Angelo Pleasant was sentenced to life with the possibility of parole plus 20 years. And to my knowledge, he served 20 years of his sentence at the Monroe State Reformatory and was released after 20 years.
Damn.
Like any guy who was given a life sentence, he has, of course, appealed. It's been denied, though.
Sorry. I'm angry. Did you say 20 years?
Yeah. Yeah, he only served 20 years. Out of a life plus 20 for two murders.
What happened to the life one? Did they just, was that a typo or?
No, it was life with parole. You know, how life means definitely life. And not anything else in this system.
And
without an LWOP.
I mean, people have done more for like weed charges.
Mm-hmm. There are still people serving longer sentences for weed charges. Isn't that
so
funny?
I mean, I'm not saying like, you know, commit crime, but certainly the premeditated assassination of a man in his driveway.
Mm-hmm.
And then the attempted cover up of something else. Warrants more than 20 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so tell me about how happily he lived his life then, because I'm sure that's what's going to happen.
No, I didn't have the stomach to follow up on that. I would like to not hear anything else about him unless it's, oh, we actually reformed some laws.
I'm so angry.
I mean, there was a Los Angeles Times article that essentially said he was in a program sewing pockets on clothing, like outerwear and sweaters, and they were sold everywhere. He earned a minimum wage. He sent a lot of that money to restitution. He took a lot of accountability, said that he was happy to be able to give something back after everything he took, which, I mean, you don't even get that all the time, so I guess at least there's that. But then he was released 20 years after being incarcerated, and now he's just hanging, to my knowledge.
It really makes you wonder. I mean, he's got to be, he's in his 70s now.
Yep.
If we're saying he was 22 and, you know, 75.
Right.
Then, I mean, it does make you wonder, though, like, what was going through his mind? Like, yeah. What was his childhood like? What was the relationship with Gabby, really? What went on behind closed doors? Because that is a fierce loyalty to a coach.
Right.
Now, I was not the most athletic child.
Same.
You got a varsity letter, so fucking, why don't you take a step back?
I swung a ball and walked 5 steps a few times.
Well.
But even with that background, even with having a coach dynamic in areas, I would not do this for any of my coaches.
I wouldn't do this for any person. I wouldn't harm that. So it just makes you think, like, what power over
right
what him, was maybe in his childhood, did this man have over him? I mean, ultimately he was an adult and he made his own decisions. He has to own that. I do not think 20 years was enough for the lives of 2 people.
No,
I'm really blown away by that.
Yep. Yeah, it's very frustrating. And while I'll say the article where he was featured talking about this program, it did seem like he took accountability. It seemed like he did some of that. But to play devil's advocate, it's really easy to tell a reporter what they want to hear.
Mm.
Also,
it's easy to be coached, no pun intended, on what to say, even by the reporters or by somebody else to say, do this and this will go. I mean, it'll surely he's got somebody for that.
Right. Or we want to make the program look good. Say this.
Mm-hmm.
You never know. But also, I mean, truly, does that negate lives? Lives. Multiple. And yes, I think that Morris was a significant loss to his family and to his community. And, you know, I can't say that it was probably the same amount of positive contribution taken away when Gabby died.
No, but he had loved ones and he had kids and he had other people that cared.
Right. And he was a person. Mm-hmm. He deserves the respect of not being killed by someone else for the sake of a cover up, mm-hmm. whether it was his idea or not. And Angelo now has to live with the fact that he killed for his coach and his coach.
Mm-hmm.
And that's got to be some trauma.
Oh, I'm sure he was like, what'd I do wrong?
Right. There's that.
How'd he die? You know, he did this for this man that probably was like, this will solidify the bond. And then now he's dead. Imagine the moment he found out this guy was dead.
Right. That it wasn't just a mere flesh wound, you know? So I don't under any circumstances condone what he did. I don't even agree that he was released, but I do feel for him.
That blows my mind.
Yep. I think this case gets to me for a lot of reasons. First, certainly, it was needless. Neither of these men needed to die, and it feels almost like a Shakespearean-level tragedy to have a mentor turned friend turned killer. Second is the mental health. There is so much struggling mental health in this, and many of these actions come from the mind of Gabby Moore, who was an incredibly unwell man. Alcoholism is part of substance use disorder, and it's a brain disorder that changes your brain chemistry. It can be fatal in many ways, and we see a very clear picture of that in today's case. Gabby, once bright, hopeful, inspiring, had started a spiral he couldn't get himself out of. Anger, violence, explosiveness, it was all there. And substance use disorder doesn't just stop there. It's one of the few diseases that actually tells you you don't have a problem. It makes getting help hard, keeping help harder, and rock bottom incredibly low. And alcohol is one of the very few drugs that can kill you just in detox, so even stopping drinking can be dangerous depending on the level of use and dependency. Gabby Moore needed psychiatric help. He needed a medical detox and treatment to work through whatever demons led him to drink in the first place. Which brings me to the second difficulty of alcoholism and substance use disorder as a whole. I think we as a society can appreciate the nuance of a disorder that changes your brain while still acknowledging the part that someone plays in that. One drink has never been demonized in American culture. I mean, fuck, we love beer stereotypically. Every American stereotype cliche song talks about God and guns and beer and the American flag.
Mm-hmm.
All right. But unlike any other mental illness, often the disease gets misconstrued as only choices that he picked to do these things, which he did. And with harder drugs that are a one and addicted kind of thing, many people blame the person with the disorder for using once. And I think we can all accept and acknowledge that Gabby is the only reason he kept drinking. Anyone with addiction is the reason they keep going, but their brain, their neural pathways, their thought processes are all being hijacked by a quiet disease. They become dependent, fixated, and obsessed. I don't think anybody has ever picked up fentanyl on the best day of their life, feeling incredibly well and happy, and just wants to try it to see what the fuck happens.
Mm-mm.
You know? And so substance use disorder is a disorder, but in my opinion, it often begins as a reaction. A poor coping skill turned darker and deadly. Gabby Moore's alcoholism is the reason a man who saved his life was murdered, and that he himself is now dead too. Angelo Pleasant pulled the trigger, make no doubt, but Gabby orchestrated that. Addiction is so complex and nuanced and deep, and while we cannot cover every element here, know that we at ATFTC promote healthy living. Get yourself to a therapist, get yourself to a doctor, and let the shit out of you that you shove down. Because from what we see, it seems like it only leads to more explosive results when you bottle it up. It's like a Diet Coke and life stressors are just playing Russian roulette to see which one of us is the Mento.
As soon as you said Diet Coke, I was like, and a Mento.
Mm-hmm. The other part of this case that gets me is Angelo Pleasant. So many people blame Deanne for what happened. And I'm not saying she was perfect, okay? I think my feelings would be incredibly hurt, my ego bruised, and my eyes puffy from crying constantly if my spouse of almost 10 years, high school sweetheart, and mother of my kids divorced me for my old wrestling coach, whose alcoholism I'd been trying to protect her from.
And assist him with, and opened my home to him.
But she didn't pull the trigger. She found out that the grass is greenest where you water it, not where whatever the weird fucking old middle school wrestling coach lays.
Mm-hmm.
And then she went back. She reconciled and she started to work on her marriage again. A blessing that Morris was open with loving arms and home for her to come home to.
Mm.
She didn't ask for Gabby to become obsessed with her. She didn't ask for him to murder her husband, and she didn't lead him on to make him think that she might. But Angelo Pleasant did both murder Morris Blankenbaker and Gabby Moore. He lost his shot at being in the Olympics, a life of normalcy outside of the prison system, lost his mentor who he did it all for, and has to reconcile that he is the man responsible for the death of that mentor. Yet, he is the only one culpable. He's the one who killed the man he had no ill will towards and another that he idolized. Angelo Pleasant could have done it for any number of reasons, and my guess is that it's probably a mix of many. I hope he uses the time that he has, that he took from Morris and Gabby, to reflect and grow. Understand the gravity of certain situations, the consequences you face, even when it was someone else's idea, and to grow a little in identifying his values, setting boundaries, and doing his best at least living a life that is in accordance with those virtues. I won't hold my breath. A comfort zone is a very beautiful thing when you're in danger, and nothing grows in a comfort zone. But prison and life marked a felon is not a very safe place, and you would have to be very dedicated to overcome that, I think. This feels like a great example of the saying that the road to hell is paved with good intentions. I don't think Angelo Pleasant hated anyone. In fact, I think this was all out of love. I think it was love for Gabby Moore. But he still took two lives unnecessarily. I understand that love is a powerful motive, perhaps the most powerful route to anything you can do. But under no duress, no hypnotism, matrix reality, altering drug, or parallel universe jumping abilities would have exonerated him from the consequences of what he did.
Mm.
For Deanne and the Blankenbaker kids, I hope they find a world where they can feel something like healed, content, and willing to love. I can only imagine what the damage of the wake of these losses caused, and I hope you've found some still water again. And that, friends, is what I have for us today.
Wow. Well,
Blinkin' Baker, you know?
You know? I have so many thoughts. I mean, obviously, it just seems like the only truly innocent person here was Morris. So, of course, you know, the only innocent person was the one that was murdered and killed first. I don't blame the wife for the murder, but I certainly blame her for her role in what led up to it.
Mm-hmm.
She certainly did not need to reciprocate the efforts made to bed her and sort of begin cheating on her husband in their own home and under the roof their children slept in.
With his middle school wrestling coach.
Yeah, and I mean, and even take that out of it. It's just, this is a man who you've just, he needs to live with you because he has imploded his life. Even if you care for the man, let's say, let's pretend. Even if you think he's a hell of a guy, you are doing no good for this person if you care for this person to involve yourself in their life when all of these things are going on.
Mm-hmm.
Attention needs to be paid to other aspects.
Yes.
You need to focus on getting back on your feet in every sense of the way and out of this house.
Yep.
And if at that time you want to pursue something, well, I mean, have the discussion with your current husband.
Yeah. I mean, he did give you that solid when he talked to you before letting the guy move in, you know.
I mean, that
be a nice one to return.
Only seems fair. But I don't think that she is the, I mean, he wanted to get back with her. But I don't think that she had any role in it, and I certainly don't think she was in on it. I don't know if she was ever accused of that, but it didn't seem like that. But then I just keep coming back to the 22-year-old kid. I'm looking at a photo of him, and he's 22. And an idiot, as we all are, and I don't mean that in like a snub way, but we make bad decisions in our younger years, but at that age, you are so aware of the permanency of what you're doing, even if you think it's worth it.
Yep. And you're aware of the consequences. You know that if you kill someone, you go to prison. And ideally, for life. And in some places, you might die too.
And it's just heartbreaking that this man had a shot. I mean, I don't know what their town was like, but I think a lot of people dream of like, I want to get out of this town.
Yep.
No matter the town, no matter how good or bad it is, but there's that, like, I want to spread my wings and fly and see what else is out there and make something of myself, right? I think that's a very human thought to have.
Yeah.
And this guy had a damn shot.
He did. I mean, he was traveling across the world to wrestle on this pre-Olympic track. And he threw it away for a man who coached him for probably, what, 8 to 16 months?
Mm-hmm.
In his middle school years.
There was not, thankfully, an adult that had that impact on me.
No.
At all.
No.
At all. There isn't anybody that I would have done those things for. And that's why I keep coming back to what was his childhood, what was his mental health, and what trauma.
Right. And for that, I think
it's worth considering. And those would have been mitigating circumstances to bring up at trial. But I don't think 20 years is worth the life of Morris.
Much less Morris and Gabby. And I think I respect a lot that he didn't go and try to point the finger at other people. He hasn't gone out there and said, no, not me. It wasn't me. It's not my fault. I didn't do this. Or I'm not responsible because my coach told me to do it.
Well, didn't he say it was his kid brother first?
Yeah. I mean, he did. And then he went and said, okay, if I did it, I'm not going to like try to wiggle my way out of this.
That's once he knew he was had, and then he was like, all right, fine, here's what happened, and then did actually tell.
But I think if he was the kind of guy who wasn't ever going to take accountability, that defense would have been riddled with duress. He made me do it. He made me think I had to do it. And as far as I've seen, nothing like that has come out of Angelo's mouth about Gabby. And I don't know if that in and of itself is another comment at the power that Gabby had over him.
That he still wouldn't speak ill of him.
Right. Maybe. Or maybe he grew up a little. I'd like to think the second one. But it might be a mix of both, even. And so I guess I hope that he was able to grow from that. I mean, he was a kid. He was stupid, but he was smart enough.
But he also wasn't a kid. Like, yeah, he's young and he's a kid. But I also think, like, when I hear of young people making really foolish decisions,
mm-hmm.
and it's like, dude, you did not know what you were doing to yourself. They're like between 16 and 19, 15 and 19, you know, yeah. like those teen years where it's like, all right, you haven't lived enough life yet. And 22 hasn't really lived enough life, but you're getting there. You're a college student. You're probably near graduating.
And we've arrested 10-year-olds for murder. Okay, so, like, premeditated. We believe they were culpable. We believe they knew what was happening was wrong and still chose to do it. And then prosecuted 10-year-olds. This man is twice that plus two.
And that's math.
Facts. But, like, what the hell?
I know. No, I'm frustrated. I'm looking at just the photos of them, and it's sad, and it's even awful that, like, you know, Morris died in the 70s, and so, you know, we in our society,
mm-hmm.
I'm gonna look out lens,
okay,
zooming out. I think we put a lot of emphasis on, like, the dash, right? You have your birth date. You have your death date, mm-hmm. and in between there's the dash. What did you do with it?
Yep.
Right? You've got, that's your life. That's your time. From the moment you breathed your first breath to the moment you breathed your last, what did you do?
Mm-hmm.
And it always is upsetting to me to see it visually when those years are so close to each other.
Right.
And with his, they're not all that far away. No. And that his life was just stolen from him. And it seems like he did a lot with his dash. He had a lot of potential to make it big, but he didn't want that. He wanted a wife, and he wanted to take care of his family, and he wanted to raise his children and raise them in the community that he knew so well and that he loved. And that's, I think, all a lot of us could ask for.
Right.
And then, you know, his dash was sort of forced, and
he was in the middle of drawing it and someone took the pen away.
Yeah, like some, you know what I mean? It sucks.
Yeah, it's really awful. It's been a hard case. I think it's been a worthwhile case, something worth looking at, listening to, seeing some of those consequences, I guess, of just living life and sort of falling victim to the mundane. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and that there's beauty in that, but you have to also make your own excitement, but that doesn't mean maybe throwing away the comforts that you've grown to take advantage of.
Yeah, and, you know, you don't have to blow up your whole spot to reinvent yourself. Get a haircut. Get bangs. You know, who knows? But you can find a hobby. Get lost in a romance novel. Spice up your sex life if that's what they need. I don't know. If they lasted another 20 years or something together, they could have ordered a weird paradise on Amazon and maybe everything would have been fine. But, like,
man.
And it's why I brought that up at the beginning of what is your ideal life? And if you see that including boring, cherish it. Don't throw it away. Because throwing it away can lead to this. It won't always, but it can.
Wow. Good job.
Thanks. It was a welcome relief from the Albert Fish series and an awful case in and of itself.
You know, we got a lot of messages about Albert Fish and, like,
sorry, guys.
Just how horrible and evil he was, and, like, how many times people had to pause and start episodes again and mm-hmm. like take a minute. I'm like, I'm sorry.
Mr. Abel Dabelson said that he needed a pause from one of them.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, you listened. Sorry.
Sorry about that. Sorry.
No, he always does. But anyway, I am so grateful for all of you for sticking it out this far. If you're interested in who we're talking about, the people, the places, the things, all of the nouns, even some of the proper nouns.
Mm.
You could do that at our Instagram, which you would find at About Time for True Crime Pod with periods in between every word. So that is ABOUT period TIME period FOR period TRUE period CRIME period POD, because podcast was too long. But if you, much like our name, wanted to email us something a wee bit longer, maybe a pod pet, maybe something your therapist told you that you were like, haha, that was funny. These two seem like they could use it. No offense taken. We probably do. You could email that to us. But Allie, where would they email that to us?
If you wanted to send us an email, you would do that to about4tc@gmail.com. So it's ABOUTTIME, numeric 4, tc@gmail.com. We love you and love getting to hang out with you. And we would definitely, again, just recommend. We are biased, but we think you should leave us a 5-star review. And
oh, that'd be so cool.
Like a little comment and things like that. Maybe if you listen on Spotify, but you have an iPhone, maybe just throw on a little 5-star, a little comment down on Apple. Cause you know, we love variety here.
Yeah, we do.
And we love you, and we will see you next time.
So if I do look at my watch, that was
about time for true crime.
Bye.
Oh, geez, Anne.